And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we speak, forest fires are blazing in Georgia and Florida. A new fire has broken out in New Jersey. The boundary waters of Minnesota and Canada are burning. The legendary Catalina Island in California witnessed a dangerous blaze. It's fire season. Today, we get an update on the fires and focus our attention on what happens to the wildlife as fires rage through the forests, swamps, and grasslands. And we have two special guests who share a bit of their new performance on the weekly Earth Summit. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Try to imagine for just a moment if you saw a raging forest fire head your way. As we speak, thousands of people around the country are facing this question. Most would pick up whatever they can, hop in their cars, and flee. But what of the wild creatures? How do they deal with forest fires? We bring you some updates on the fires and then head to the Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge in southern Georgia and talk with Ranger Sally Gentry about how the wildlife there are faring as over 50% of the refuge has been burned. That's coming up in our second segment. But as always, we begin today's show with the most important 15 minutes on Earth as we hear from the world's leading scientists, activists, and advocates for nature in our weekly Earth Summit. And today, we have two very special guests joining the summit who will provide a wonderful sampler from their newest performance, Sea Change, Reversing the Tide. So now, join us for this latest Voice of the Earth special edition. This is Sydney Wildsmith. I want to welcome you all to this week's very special Weekly Earth Summit, bringing you the most important 15 minutes on Earth each and every week. Today, we will be hearing from many of our regular panelists who continue to bring you up to date on the changes and opportunities we face in uniting to restore a balance to our Earth. I thank you for attending, and please tell your friends and associates to join our global network of Friends of the Earth. And today we have two special guests who will close out this week's summit with a very special performance from their upcoming series of live performances of Sea Change, Reversing the Tide. It's a most elegant and powerful tribute to nature, life, and wonder. So I'd like now to introduce our first regular panelist, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, our resident ethologist, who wishes to open today's summit with a personal observation on what we have to lose if we cannot act in time to save the wild creatures. Dr. Beckhoff?
A lot of people are interested these days in the loss of species, mass extinctions. You know, we're in the sixth period of extinction, and it's unprecedented in terms of the anthropogenic, if you will, or human-caused extinctions. And people say, you know, what are we going to lose? Well, we're going to lose a lot of species. We're going to lose habitats as these species leave, of course. Either, you know, the habitats will be converted by humans into apartment houses, which probably won't happen. But you know, we'll be taken over perhaps for growing crops. But what I think we also lose, in addition to the species and the habitat, is we just lose, if you will, part of who we are. I like to think of all beings as being connected on Earth, and so that a loss of a particular species or even the reduction of the numbers of a particular species down very low to where they may not be sustainable over time is really just a loss of kin. It's kind of loss of a brother or a loss of a sister. And I think what those losses are going to do sooner than later, is I think they're going to be crazy-making. I tell my classes that these losses are going to be crazy-making in the sense that we will be losing a connection to the world, if you will, the animal world, the world of other nature. We'll be alone. We won't be able to stand the cold, as the philosopher Nietzsche said. And so that's what I'm really concerned about. And there's wonderful people, of course, working on conservation, from my colleague and friend Jane Goodall to George Shala to innumerable people. It would be just ridiculous to try to list them all. But I do think that those will be our losses, a loss of wildness, a loss of nature, and a loss of attachment. We still have very old brains, although we're pretty advanced in other ways. And I think our old brains really, really crave connection to nature. So that's where I'm at now.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. Dr. Beckhoff, besides being a world-class animal behaviorist, is also a prolific writer. So I encourage you to Google Mark Beckhoff, that's MarkBeckoff, to find and explore with him the wonders of animal intelligence, emotion, and play through his many books and articles. Now, preserving biological diversity, as you all know, is a primary aim of all of our panelists. I want to now introduce another of our regular panelists, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who played a key role in bringing this concept, biological diversity, into our awareness. Dr. Lovejoy.
In 1980, there were three of us who used the phrase biological diversity for the first time. We were basically, each of us was looking for a way to describe the total variety of life on Earth. And so we all came independently to the phrase. We just wanted a way to talk about this, the extraordinary richness of life on this planet, whether we looked at it at the level of an individual species and all its variation, or the whole variety of species on Earth, or the variety of ecosystems, which in the end makes this planet a truly glorious and exciting place to live. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's inspiring. It also happens to be the very basis for our existence. Biological diversity does all kinds of stuff for us. You know, it underpins us biologically, it performs ecosystem services, it provides sort of basic encyclopedia about living systems on Earth. But it's also, you know, it's just extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful. And I think one of the most important things each and every person should do with some frequency is just stop for a minute and, in a sense, smell the roses of the diverse planet on which we live. Because, you know, anytime you really stop and look at a plant or an animal, how it's put together and how it works, it's enthralling. And to lose any of it is worse than the worst book burning one can imagine. Just a wonderful, beautiful, inspiring world. We should treasure it.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. Currently, Dr. Lovejoy heads the Heinz Foundation for Science, Economics, and the Environment. In order to succeed, the mandate to think globally and act locally has even more significance as we face the myriad challenges of keeping individual species from becoming extinct. The weekly Earth Summit will spotlight critical needs as identified by our panelists who work each day to protect the living diversity. Dr. Robin Moore works with the Amphibian Specialist Group of Conservation International in just such direct action. Dr. Moore identifies a critical challenge facing the world today. Dr. Moore.
The gastric brooding frog was discovered around 35 years ago. It was native to Queensland, Australia, where it lived in creeks and rainforests. It's a ground-dwelling frog very closely associated with water. It's fairly unremarkable in appearance, being small and brown. But what is very unusual about this frog is the way in which it reproduced. After breeding, the female would take the eggs into her mouth and swallow them. Here she would hold around 40 eggs until they hatched. The tadpoles would live in her stomach and metamorphose into fully formed froglets. The froglets would then emerge from the female's mouth. This highly unusual behavior was made possible by substance in the egg of the frog, which actually turned off the production of hydrochloric acid in the female's stomach. So she would not be able to feed in the whole time that the eggs and the tadpoles were present in her stomach. Unfortunately, this highly unusual frog disappeared from existence in the mid-80s. The reason for its extinction is not entirely clear, but habitat loss, pollution, and an emerging infectious disease, a fungus called chytridiomycosis, have all been implicated, and it's likely to be a combination of these factors. Sadly, this story is becoming very familiar among frogs, as we're losing many species from around the world. Not only is the loss of gastric breeding frog tragic from a perspective of losing a species, it also has implications for humans. The mechanism by which the female turned off the production of acid in her stomach is not entirely understood, and it could have implications for the treatment of ailments that affect humans, such as stomach ulcers. Now the potential for doing research has gone. We're trying to stop other species going extinct from around the world and losing similar opportunities. If you'd like to find out more information about what we're doing, please visit www.amphibians.org.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. I hope all of you will take even a little bit of your time to assist in this effort. We need global response now. The truth is, we all need to make special efforts. We now get a personal perspective on where we can look to keep our dedication alive, as we welcome one of our college voices representing the newest action generation. Ben Lowe is moving out into the world of action, having just graduated from Wheaton College. Ben?
In an era where it is easy to despair over the state of the environment, the church may be our best hope yet. For some time, economics has been the baseline motivation behind much environmental protection. We're usually willing to go green, provided we save money, or at the very least, break even. If not, then forget about it. The problem is that this only gets us so far, and often not far enough. Well, what next then? We need a new motivation to move us past the economics. This new motivation is morality. Morals compel us to take care of the environment because it is the right thing to do. This does not mean we ignore the economics, but it does mean protecting the environment may entail making sacrifices. So where do we get our morals? One obvious place is from our faith. This is what led Karl Popp to say of his generation, "We acted as if we could save life on Earth without the same institutions through which we save ourselves." For many around the world, this institution is the church. And it was Jesus himself who taught that you cannot serve both God and mammon. According to the church, then, God must be the ultimate decision-making factor, not personal gain nor financial profit. And God calls us to love our neighbors and care for his creation.
Thank you, Ben. It will be interesting to follow Ben as he applies that will to the wild choices and voices of our future. And we'd better plan on adopting this as our collective global challenge with a timeline that runs deep into this century of change. Dr. Charles Kennell has looked at the Earth from the deep recesses of space with his work with NASA to the deepest depths of the oceans as director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. That pretty much defines the living strata on planet Earth. So Dr. Kennell talks about a strategic and timely framework for our future. Dr. Kennell?
I think the crunch, the true crunch, is going to come in at mid-century, about 40 to 50 years' time. And the reason is, my reason is, that the UN predicts that the global population may very well level off at that time, at about 9.5 billion people. Now, that means that at that time, we're going to have to learn how to clothe, house, feed, provide employment for, and a prosperous way of life for half again as many people as presently inhabit the Earth. Now, the UN believes that the population is going to level off because of a demographic transition that has occurred in advanced economies, where the rate of growth does slow down, and people think that it is indirectly connected with prosperity and maybe more directly connected with things like education of women and so on. But nonetheless, there's a connection between prosperity and the slowing population growth. The first condition for a stable human-occupied Earth is a constant population. That can't be achieved without having economic growth around the world. Our record in the 20th century, where in the last 50 years we achieved quite a bit, particularly in Asia, our record is not so good as far as the environment is concerned, because all of that economic growth came at increased compromise of the environment and increased and unsustainable uses of resources. So the challenge is to arrive at this 50-year mark, understanding how to deal with the global environmental consequences of the economic growth that's necessary to see a stable population. And people think the crunch will actually come at that time, because the population may level off, may even peak. And our resource consumption and environmental effects will probably be greatest then. And we still won't have learned how to cope with all the challenges after 50 years. And so that's probably their critical point. Now, E.O. Wilson has called this, the great biologist E.O. Wilson has called this a bottleneck, that if we get through, we may very well be on a different path for the globe. But he's very worried. He thinks, I've heard him state publicly, that we may have lost 50% of all the species on Earth before we get through this bottleneck. So I think a number of people look forward to about 50 years as crunch time. And that's within the lifetime of our grandchildren.
Dr. Kennel will be meeting with us each week to share his perspectives. Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Sometimes the challenges seem monumental, and that's one reason Dave Foreman, founder of the Rewilding Institute, joins us each week, because he is a man of action. He invites everyone to act right now to save one highly endangered species. Dave?
Wasn't very long ago, just a few hundred years ago, that jaguars, the big spotted cat of the Western Hemisphere, ranged throughout the southern United States, from California to Tennessee. That's a surprising historical fact to most people. But today, there are a few jaguars in the United States, in extreme southern Arizona and southwestern New Mexico. But they seem to all be males. There is not a breeding population of the big spotted cat. The nearest breeding population of jaguars to the United States, it's just 100 miles south of the Arizona border in northern Sonora, where the Yaqui River headwaters are. And out of that population, few jaguars have dispersed into the United States. There are estimated to be about 120 breeding jaguars in that population, just 100 miles south of the border. The trouble is, in Mexico, there is no public land, and the prime habitat for this jaguar population is owned by a single rancher who is virulently anti-jaguar and other predators and has been killing them, even though that is illegal in Mexico. Naturalia, a Mexican conservation group, and the Northern Jaguar Project, with which the Rewilding Institute and I are associated, has been trying to raise money to buy those ranches owned by the jaguar-killing rancher, and he is willing to sell them. Already managed to purchase one ranch of about 15,000 acres and set up the Los Pavos Jaguar Preserve. But now we are trying to buy another 40,000 some acres from this rancher, which will get him out of the area, and other surrounding ranchers are open-minded and possibly friendly to jaguars. But we have to raise a lot of money right now. We have a $100,000 down payment we need to make by the end of May. And so what we are asking folks to do is to buy an acre for spot. If we're ever going to have a breeding population of jaguars back in the United States, We have to strongly protect this population of jaguars in Sonora and their dispersal routes into the United States. And so for only $49, you can buy an acre for spot down in Mexico, and we will soon have a nearly 50,000-acre jaguar preserve owned by Naturalia and the Northern Jaguar Project. To help donate and to find out more about the Northern Jaguar Reserve, just go to www.northernjaguarproject.org, and you can donate your $49 or how many acres you want to buy through that website. Thanks very much.
If anyone else feels like $49 an acre is a bargain, as I do, buy in and get the job done. This is a small price to pay for such a monumental demonstration of actions that lead to a sustainable future. Thank you, Dave Foreman. Dr. Matthew Sleeth brings his humanness and humanity to the dais each week and inspires us with his faith and commitment to serve God and save the planet. Matthew?
Not long ago, my daughter Em and I went for a walk. We wound our way along the trail that took its course between thicket and stream. It was an overcast day. We paused to study a tree overgrown with vines. In its architecture, a score of sparrows went about the business of blending in with everything. I do not spend enough time in nature, despite my telling others that it is vital to do so. It is too easy to be caught up in the world. It's too easy to forget that nature has a power to restore multitask modern humans. I spend my days and nights convincing audiences of the need to restore creation, and yet I lose sight of creation's ability to restore me. As Em and I went about our walk, we came upon an area of trees surrounding a small stream. Scattered along the stream banks are dozens of cast-off washing machines, tires, and even an automobile. This most quiet and modest of groves has been turned into a dump, a place to cast off the machinery of our hubris. In the time after our walk, the image of the grove haunted me. St. Paul writes that creation groans as a woman in the throes of painful childbirth. His description fits many natural habitats under siege by society. It describes what I had seen. As servants of the Lord, we exist to do His bidding. We are the hands, feet, and sentient instruments of the Almighty. The junk cast off by the stream is an affront to God. It is increasingly clear that we must not only cease harming the created world, we must throw ourselves into the work of healing the damage already done to it. The stream bed needs to be delivered of its travail, but who will do the work? Next week, I'll talk about the watershed's unlikely midwives.
Dr. Sleeth is a self-sacrificing man and is a new missionary for the earth. You may be amazed that Matthew makes his message available to those who ask. So contact Dr. Sleeth through his website at servegodsavetheplanet.org. I'm very pleased to welcome now two very special guests who have dedicated their lives to inspiring millions through their creative and scientific quest. Lisa Harrell is a legendary star of stage and screen who began her career with the Royal Shakespeare Company and is considered one of the finest actors alive. She met and married Roger Payne, who has studied the behavior of whales, leading over 100 expeditions to all oceans and studying every species of baleen whale in the wild. His institute has recently completed the Voyage of the Odyssey, a 5-year around-the-world research expedition to measure pollution levels in the oceans. Lisa's and Roger's shared environmental interests have led to the creation of Sea Change, Reversing the Tide, a performance piece that uses science and poetry to urge us all to make sustainable living our primary goal. We are honored and delighted to hear a brief sampling from their live performance, which will be premiering Thursday, May 24th at the Cherry Lane Theater in New York City as a first of a series of performances around the country. Please welcome Lisa Harrell and Roger Payne.
The area needed to keep up with our demands sustainably now equals the surface of this entire planet plus an area equal to the agricultural regions of Europe and Australia. But we need to ask ourselves, where are we going to get to other areas the size of Europe and Australia?
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life or my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds.
There is new evidence that the Greenland ice cap is now starting to melt, a process which, when complete, will raise sea levels by 20 feet.
If we do not begin to work together for the well-being of each other, the planet's surge of life may well be done with.
The monolithic indifference of natural laws to our preferences is total. They will never adapt to our desires, not even once. It is we who must adapt to them. Always. Every time. No exceptions.
The whales turn and glisten, plunge and sound and rise again, flowing like breathing planets in the sparkling whorls of living light.
Humanity's worst problems are solvable. Most solutions are simple. Existing scientific understanding is strong enough to get us started.
There is, in fact, a new industrial revolution underway that can prevent us from laying waste to the beauty of the world.
Because the stakes are now so high, our present predicament is actually the most singular opportunity for greatness ever offered to any generation in any civilization.
We need to seize that opportunity and act.
28 years ago, some songs of humpback whales that I had recorded were included on two golden records that were placed aboard each of the Voyager spacecraft. When Voyager 1 was 3.7 billion miles from Earth, its cameras were turned around to look back over its shoulder so that it could film the entire solar system. In the resulting image, the Earth occupies 1/8 of 1 pixel. It is shown as a pale blue dot, illuminated by what looks like a sunbeam. But it was simply a stray reflection from the spacecraft itself.
Look at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being that ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering. Thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager. Every hero and coward. Every creator and destroyer of civilization. Every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there. On a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.
Thank you both for your soul-filled work for life on Earth. With ticket prices at $10, you can afford to plan to attend this very special premiere. To find out more, visit their website at redshiftproductions.org. So I want to thank all of our panelists who will continue to lead us and inspire us all to reverse the tidal wave of chaos and restore the balance and peace to Earth. We all look forward to meeting with you next week and every week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth at our weekly Earth Summit. Fires are raging. We seem to focus entirely on the human impact. But over this break, imagine for just 1 minute what happens to the millions of creatures whose homes are burned in any single fire. What's it all mean? We take a look when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
A dirty look. Shrinking glaciers? A nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather? An uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.